I go off down to Varian over in the Bay Area in California, who makes the machine, the Varian Corporation. And I said, look at this data here. It makes no sense at all. What's going on here with this machine? That's got to be something you can explain, right? And they looked at it and they said, Dave, you're cooling the sample. We say it's superconducting. But in as much as you're heating the sample, we have no idea whatsoever what's going on. And I said, what do you mean by superconductivity? I mean, I don't know what superconductivity is. And they said, well, it's literally a material that is so sensitive to magnetic fields. And I said, well, how sensitive? They said, well, a superconductor will respond to a magnetic field of 2 times 10 to the minus 15th hertz. I said, that's great. What the dirt? They said, there's 10 to the 18th power ergs in a gauss. I said, what's a gauss? And they said, well, the Earth's magnetic field that it compasses the lines with is about 0.56 gauss. So if a gauss is a little bit more than the Earth's magnetic field, then an erg is 10 times 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 10, 18 times. There's that many ergs in a gauss. So an erg is a little bitty amount of magnetic field. In other words, they talk about the charge around an electron. They talk about that in ergs. One electron. So that's a little bitty tiny measure of magnetic field. Okay? A superconductor responds to 2 times 10 to the minus 15th ergs. Or 0.00000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000000 little bitty. That's nothing. That's nothing. In other words, if a star twinkles in the heavens, it affects the superconductor. And this is really sensitive stuff. In fact, come to find out that the way they see your thoughts in your brain is with a superconducting quantum interference device called a SQUID, a superconducting ring that they put around your head, and they give you something sweet, and when you taste it, this part of your brain lights up. And they see it with a SQUID. Or they give you something sour, this part of your brain lights up. But you get mad at your wife and the whole thing goes crazy. They actually see your thoughts with a superconductor. And I said, boy, this is sensitive, isn't it? And they said, so, wouldn't you understand that the heating element on the furnace, it's bifilar wound, so they actually, the coils go up like this, they get the top and they come back down, and they actually cross each other so that they cancel each other's field. So electricity's going this way, and then it comes back the other way, you know, but it's crossing, so the wires go like this, on top of each other. And that's called bifilar winding. They use it in electronics. And that's so the fields cancel each other and there's no field. But in fact, it is impossible for the wire to really be exactly in the same place. They have to be right beside each other. And when they do that, there is that tiny residuum in the field, this little bit of imbalance that isn't exactly the same. And that's enough field to affect the superconductor. And I said, well then, you think this stuff could be a superconductor? And they says, well, if you're a coolant, we'd say it was. So I actually got a bunch of books over in England, and I started to read about superconductivity. And this is really important, people, to understand, because this is the basis of everything. I think it was what Rompa says, you call this superconductivity? Okay. All right, I actually took this white powder, and I put it on the table, and I get a voltmeter. Now, a voltmeter has two electrodes, and you hook it up on a piece of wire, and you turn on the battery pack. It's actually a battery-powered machine, and it measures the conductivity on the wire between these two electrodes. So I take this little instrument, and I set it on my powder, and I put it at both ends of the powder, and I turn this battery pack on. I figured, this is just going to be like touching these electrodes together. It's going to be dead short, right? It's a superconductor, right? So I put it on, turn it on, nothing happens. I said, well, this isn't a perfect conductor. This is a perfect insulator. Nothing flows at all. And then I get to the second chapter in the book. find out that a superconductor, by definition, is not a perfect conductor. A superconductor is a material that does not allow any external magnetic field to exist in the sample. Okay? No external magnetic field can exist in a superconductor when it's superconducting. So my battery pack actually has electricity in it, and it requires a voltage potential to get the electron off the wire and into the sample. And it takes a voltage potential to get the electricity out of the sample and into the wire. But by definition, the sample, if it's a superconductor, doesn't allow any voltage potential to exist in it. So there's no way to get the electricity off this wire and into the sample. So that means it's absolutely worthless. Well, then I got to chapter 3. And then it says that everywhere in the superconductor, it's like a laser. There's a single frequency light in the superconductor. So everywhere in the superconductor, it is single frequency of light, all one frequency. And what it said is you have to resonance frequency tune the vibrating electron on the metal to agree with the frequency of the superconductor. And when you have it tuned to its exact correct match with the superconductor, then the electrons will pair up and go on as electron pairs in the superconductor with no push at all. Because they're always moving on the wire continually anyway, not really going anyplace. But when you give them a superconductor and resonance frequency tune them, they literally go on to the superconductor because they're seeking the path of least resistance. And that's in the superconductor. So all these electrons, the spin one-half electron and the spin one-half time reverse electron, now become spin one boson and go on as light. That's real important to understand. The spin one-half electron and the time reverse spin one-half electron pair together and form a spin one boson, and they lose all particle aspect. So this particle plus this particle is no particle. It's physics, don't ask me. It's just physics. So one-half plus one-half is one, and that has no halves. Anyway, it's just light. Now, the really strange thing here is an electron exists in space-time, and another electron exists in space-time. And these two electrons can't cohabitate. They won't get together. They exist in space-time. They won't occupy the same space-time. But when they pair up, then they lose all particle aspect, and millions of phonons can exist in the same space-time. Isn't that weird? I mean, gosh, what's going on here? So what happens, as long as you have the wire resonance frequency tuned to the vibrational frequency of the superconductor, and you have it attached to a source of electrons like the Earth, drive a stop on the ground, hook the wire up to it, they literally go on forever and ever and ever, just keep going on, and they don't have to come off. You just go on, keep going in there, just keep going. And now you say, okay, how do I know they're in there? There's no way to measure them when they're in there. All your instruments are based on deflection or differential. But there's no way you can measure differential because there is no differential. There's no voltage. A perfect superconductor can flow up to 200,000 amps with no potential. 200,000 amps per square foot with no potential. So you can actually put this superconductor up, flowing 200,000 amps per square foot, and hold it against your cheek, and there's no tingle, there's no tickle, there's no sparks, nothing. Because there's no volts. Okay? It's just light. Like liquid light flowing. Now the other thing you need to understand is the light does not flow at the speed of light. The light actually flows at the speed of sound. Which is very important. It flows within the superconductor at the speed of sound. So actually you can kind of see it move. You know, it's kind of like liquid light flowing in there. So how do you know what's in there? Well, what you do is you read the amount of magnetic field that's being produced around the sample. So now we're at another thing we got to learn. A superconductor, when it is flowing current inside the superconductor, forms around a magnetic field, just like a wire when it's flowing current forms around it a magnetic field. Except this magnetic field isn't formed by electrons, it's formed by electron pairs or light. So the field it produces is not a positive field or a negative field, it's a zero field or a null field. It has no north or south pole. So the field it produces repulses north poles and it repulses the south poles. It's a null field. So as the current's going into it, or the amperage, literally the field gets larger and larger and larger and larger and larger. But it's a null field. And so it repulses all external magnetic fields. So whether you have a north pole or a south pole, or you have voltage potential or whatever you have, it will not penetrate the sample. It won't get in the sample. It hits it and is deflected around it. If you get a high enough field, it actually feeds into the superconductor. It eats the field. If you get a high enough field, it actually pulls that energy into the superconductor and flows more light from the field. So this isn't at all like electricity. Electricity resists the field. This, if you put a field to it, it eats the field. Wow. This is really strange. So how do you get the current out of a superconductor? You have to hook the wire up to the superconductor, and then you have to resonance frequency tune the vibrating frequency of the wire to match the vibrating frequency of the superconductor, and then apply a voltage. And out come the electron pairs, and they become electrons, and now they're in the wire going on down the road. But the neat thing about this is you can put electricity in this in Seattle and run the superconductor all the way to New York City. And you put the energy on in Seattle, and you can wait for 2 months and go to New York City and take it out. It's all there. It's a quantum phenomenon. It runs forever and ever and ever. You can actually approach a superconductor with a magnetic field, and it starts superconducting in response to the field. It takes the magnetic field into the superconductor as electron pairs and flows light in response to the field. Well, literally, the Earth's magnetic field is a tremendous magnetic field for a superconductor. It's 0.56 Gauss, which, gosh, that's a long ways from 2 times 10 to the minus 15th ergs, right? That's a monster field. So literally, it begins superconducting in response to the Earth's magnetic field. And it's flowing so much current inside of it that it levitates on the Earth's magnetic field. It cannot be weighed. It won't drop down because the Earth's magnetic field goes around it and holds it in the field. So then it floats. So in 1988, we filed U.S. and worldwide patents on ORMs. In March of 88, ORMs, and that was a refiling, ORMs, orbitally rearranged monatomic elements, and S-ORMs, the mini-atom system of superconducting ORMs. So we had all these patents on ORMs, all these elements, and we had another series of patents on S-ORMs, the mini-atom system of resonance-coupled atoms. And when you understand that a superconductor will not let any magnetic field in the sample, it reflects all light, what color does it have to be? White. All light's reflected, so it has to be white or invisible. So anyway, we got this filed in March of 88, and I didn't realize that any patent on superconductivity requires approval of the Department of Defense. They forgot to tell me that part. Anyway, we go rolling along nice and comfortable. You got a year's grace here from the U.S. Patent Office that if you file your patent worldwide within a year, everything's going to be rosy. So come 3 weeks before the end of our year, we notify them we're going to file our worldwide patent. Well, before they answered, somebody went back and reread the patent. They realized it was superconductivity. Nobody picked up on this. I said it has hoofs, it has horns, it goes moo, it gives milk, and it has baby calves, but I never call it a cow. So anyway, when they went back and read it, they said, uh-oh, off to Department of Defense it goes. Department of Defense comes back and says, you cannot file this worldwide. It's strategic importance to this country. And we said, wait a minute. By law, I have to be given a 6-month appeal period. You've only got 3 weeks. By this time, Palms and Fleischman had filed all their information on cold fusion, which if you know this, you now know what cold fusion is. I said, no. We've got to have this date. So the patent office says, okay, go ahead and file it worldwide. We'll override the Department of Defense. So in March of 88, we filed U.S. and worldwide patents worldwide in every country but China and the Soviet Union. Well, needless to say, my name was Mud. at the Department of Defense. They said, well, if we can't prevent him from filing this patent, we're going to learn everything he knows. And so I get this phone call from this man who says, Dave, I want to invest in your technology. I said, how do you know anything about my technology? Well, he says, well, I know you're doing this, now you're doing this. And he's telling me things specifically out of my patent. And nobody's supposed to ever seen this patent. You know, the Patent Review Board's supposed to have seen it. And the Department of Defense Review Board's supposed to have seen it. But nobody in the military should know about this. And yet this man's quoting me verbatim from my patent. So I hired a private investigator to check him out, find out who he is. Come to find out, he flies out of Langley Air Force Base. And what happened is when the military went to Congress to get approval of funds for Star Wars, Congress turned them down. And so what they did is they took a bunch of covert money and they put it over in Swiss bank accounts, and this man takes that money and goes to companies who have technologies that serve the Department of Defense interest, and he invests money in them. And then you have a partner at the Department of Defense. And so I said, no, I don't think we need your help. And he said, Dave, you will never prove this without us. You will wait 2-3 years before you can ever get your material on the neutron deflection studies, which are the absolute proof of superconductivity. A superconductor repulses all external magnetic fields, including the spin charge of a neutron. A neutron has no polarity, but it does have a spin charge. And a superconductor is the only thing that literally will deflect the spin charge of a neutron. So anything that's superconducting cannot be seen with neutron activation. I said, well, I already know that. I don't need that analysis. Anyway, he was back 2 or 3 times, and after that, he just dropped it and left. He never came back. We just continued along our merry way doing our research.